session today will be House Bill 2387, House Bill 2410, House Bill 2339, and House Bill 2352. We have with us this morning on the telephone, Mr. Martin Leuenberger. And I will have, Counsel Chartel, please give us a summary on 2387.
Thank you, Chair Walker, members of the committee. House Bill 2387 allows a judge in an action for partition or sale of property to make an order permitting an owner, any owner, to borrow money upon a property with which to pay off the interest of another owner without regard to which owner opposes partition or sale. What that means is that regardless of whether or not you're the person that instigates the partition proceeding or the person that opposes it, you would be eligible to purchase the property if the judge makes the determination that that is the best resolution. Under current law, the Court of Appeals has interpreted ORS 105.210 as barring a judge from ordering the sale to the person that initiated the partition. So if you're the one that tries to solve the problem by instigating the partition process, the Court of Appeals has said that the law prevents you from being the one that then can be able to purchase the land.
Okay. First, we will have Mr. Leuenberger. Would you please state your name?
Martin Leuenberger.
Thank you. Go ahead. You may proceed with your testimony, Mr. Leuenberger.
The significance of this bill, as counsel has said, statutes involving partition allow the court to physically partition the property, and if that cannot be done without great prejudice, then the property can be sold. Now, if that can't be done without great prejudice to one of the parties, such as an instance perhaps where one of the parties uses the property as an integral part of the business, then the court can allow presently the person objecting to the partition to use the land as security to buy out the interest of the other party. In essence, this allows someone to hold another party hostage. That's the Opie case, which I cited in my letter to Neil Bryant. And this change in the law would simply allow the court to provide that either party might be able to use the property as security to pay off the various interests, including the interest of the other co-owner. And so it levels the playing field. I've run into this in several cases, and it becomes quite a strategic thing. How do you get out of a joint ownership when you're not getting along with your co-owner, yet still have the opportunity to keep and use the land, which may be integral to your economic interests?
Thank you, Mr. Leuenberger. Anyone on the panel have a question for Mr. Leuenberger?
Could we please, yes, Madam Chair.
Representative Lowe.
Good morning, Mr. Leuenberger.
Morning.
Could you please give us something of your background and how these cases arise and in what context? Are you talking primarily about business dissolutions or what?
Okay. I'm an attorney. I've been a member of the Oregon Bar for 25 years. My practice is largely in the fields of real estate, commercial transactions, mining, and banking. This involves real property. And, of course, real property can be an integral part of a business. The Opie case, which I would hope you have reference to before you, involved a ranch. And I had a recent case where there was a lodge on a river, a fishing lodge, owned by two parties. One party used the lodge integrally as part of his guiding business. He would guide fishermen for steelhead fishing. And it became quite a problem because we did not feel we should file a partition suit because then we couldn't purchase, and he needed to purchase that. So the other side could, in essence, hold him hostage. With this bill, you know, the party, in that case my client, could have filed the suit. The land could not have been partitioned physically because of zoning. It could not have been sold without doing great prejudice to my client's business interests. And under the present law, my client would not have been able to sue and then be allowed to purchase the property. It ended up the parties resolved the case, but as you can see, it caused a great deal of consternation for us.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Madam Chair.
Representative Shetterly.
Thank you. Mr. Lundberger, I'm an attorney. I've never had a partition case. I don't think I can recall having had one anyway. So as I understand the statute as it stands now, whether or not you would have the right to be the purchaser in a partition case depends on whether you're the plaintiff or defendant. Is that it?
It is, to the extent that the court does not order a sale on the courthouse step.
Right, right. But as between the two parties anyway, or we assume two parties for these purposes.
Right. Then the plaintiff cannot purchase under the present law.
Very interesting.
And for the members of the committee, I do have a copy of the OP case. I didn't photocopy them for you. I have read it. If you want copies, I can provide them to you.
Representative Law.
Mr. Lowenberger, in the context of, say, a creditor acquiring one of the interests, a joint interest in the property, would this be, this would put the, say, the homeowner in a huge disadvantage, would it not?
Well, I don't believe it would. In the case of a homeowner, of course, you've got the exemption to begin with. Now, that, you know, certainly the property can be sold. But in that case, is it really fair to the creditor also to purchase it? Most creditors don't want the land. They want their money, at least financial institutions do, and I represent a lot of those, too. All they want is their money. They don't want the land. Certainly, aberrations can occur, but every partition suit I've been involved with or heard of has been a case where there have been long-time joint owners. It has not been as the result of a creditor seizing an undivided interest in property.
Follow up. Thank you, Madam Chair. So oftentimes this is in a, happens when there's a partnership dissolution.
There you go, yeah.
It's been my observation that quite often having the prohibition against either party being able to purchase forces them into a settlement of the part of not only who owns the land or what happens to that property, but the collateral issues surrounding the partnership dissolution. Isn't that basically the reason why the statute exists the way it does and the case law exists the way it does?
I don't believe so, because if that were the case, the statute wouldn't be there in any form. In other words, if it can't be physically partitioned, it would be sold on the courthouse steps, which the court has power to do, and there'd be a bidding war. That argument doesn't work, because why would one party be allowed to purchase when the other couldn't? And of course, if the statute is modified by the legislature, it's in the sound discretion of the court, after hearing all the evidence, who would be greatly prejudiced by the inability to purchase.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay. Thank you. Mr. Lewenberg, if you would like, we can keep you on the line. We have one more party to testify.
Sure.
Otherwise, if you need... Oh, okay, you do. All right. Brad Swank.
Good morning, Chair Walker, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Brad Swank. I'm with the State Court Administrator's Office, and I'm not here today on the policy of the bill. I'm just here on a small technical procedural issue related to it. I noticed as I was looking through the bill on in line 14, it has the money being paid into court if it's bought off. Now, that's the current procedure that's in the statute, but I was just wondering if it was still a good idea to always require the state to handle the money when it's being paid off, or whether it wouldn't be appropriate to allow people to submit proof to the court that they've paid the other party, rather than forcing the, you know, when the clerk takes the money, they have to give a receipt and take it in and put it in the trust account, and then check has to clear, and when it clears, they have to send it out. It does cost the state money. It's not a big issue. It won't involve a lot of money. I was just wondering if it wouldn't be worth on line 14 changing payment in court to proof filed with the court of payment of, and that way you would eliminate an old process and allow people to file proof so they could pay directly without forcing the state to handle the money. That's the only issue I've got. I thought I'd raise it for your consideration. Thank you very much. Answer any questions if you have them.
Do we have any questions for Mr. Swank?
No,
Representative Shirley?
I'm curious, Mr. Lumberger, is there a response to that since he deals with these cases?
Thank you, pardon?
Mr. Lumberger, Representative Shetterly asked if you could respond to the suggestion of Mr. Swank in regards to changing on line 14 where it says payment in court, to change that to proof filed in the court in the payment of.
I don't have any problem with that. In fact, with all due respect to the court system of which I'm an officer, I think most of us would rather pay the fee and have an independent escrow do it because it works more quickly and more efficiently.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Swank.
And if I could just inform the members of the committee, I have talked to two other people that may have had interest in this bill, Tim Martinez. Said no problems with the bill, and Craig Chisholm, who is involved in land title, and he and Mr. Lumberger had quite a conversation about the bill, the purpose of the bill. He was on vacation at the time and didn't have the bill in front of him. He said in theory he didn't have any problems with the bill. It made sense to him. It was a common sense sort of change that he was going to be back in town today. And then he understood that even if we acted on the bill today, he would have an opportunity to actually look at it physically.
Other question? Comment?
Manager, it seems if we want to go ahead and get an amendment done, let's bring it back, and it sounds like a good bill.
I think so. We can get the amendment done. Sounds like a good change. And then we'll bring it back.
Okay. Mr. Lundberger, I'll arrange to get the amendment done, and I will let you know when it's going to be back on the schedule.
Okay. Thank you very much, and I'm sorry for the confusion about this.
That's all right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye.
The hearing on 2387 will be continued. We receive the amendment.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
In this case, could you direct counsel to the committee to look into what the Maupin argument was?
You actually have a copy of it right in front of you.
Oh, here it is.
Yes, it was delivered just a moment ago.
And what I can tell you...
Hot breath.
Okay. What I can tell you about that case is that it involved a ranch, as Mr. Lindberg said. The plaintiffs in the case were the people that had lived on the property. It was a family situation, and it was owned by various members of the family. But the people that finally moved for the partition in court were the people that had actually lived on the land for 20 or 30 years. And the original trial court had gone through all of the various calculations that are supposed to be done, the weighing of the different factors that are supposed to be done, and determined that it made sense that the plaintiffs in the case, the people that originally moved for the partitions, for the sale of the property to anyone but themselves, and ordered the defendants in the case to sell to the plaintiffs. The Court of Appeals determined that based on the law that said that only a person objecting to the partition could buy the land in the trial court decision, although it made sense given the, all of the factors, it wasn't allowed by law. If I can point you to...
That's okay.
Okay.
I'll read it.
All right.
Thank you.
Okay. House Bill 2410. Council, please read the summary.
2410 is a bill... I believe because Tim Shetterly was involved in this organization, the Polk County Victim Offender Reconciliation Program, and I believe that she was board, and the issue came up as to liability for board members. And I've spoken to Sandy Patterson, who I here, and talked to her about the point of this bill. And what it does is, there are several mediation programs around the state. They're all, some of them are run a little bit differently, but the main idea is to get parties in and have them mediate their disputes rather than go through the courts. Right now, the people, the volunteers that provide those mediation services, they are exempted from liability in current statutes. And what this bill would do would just extend that liability to other people involved in the organization, the officers, the directors, employees, and agents of the mediation program. The intent behind this bill, according to Ms. Patterson, is to, these organizations are run on very, very tight, small budgets. Liability insurance can be anywhere from $800 to $1,000. That's a lot when you're talking about a small budget. And most of the people that they're trying to get involved in these organizations don't have access to, for example, liability insurance through their homeowners policies, as some people might. This would encourage or allow people to serve on boards that didn't have that kind of personal liability insurance.
Thank you, counsel. First witness, Sandy Patterson.
Good morning. Andrea, you totally summarized everything that I was really going to say here, but yes, I am very, very fortunate to have Francine Shutterly on my board of directors. She has been the chairman for many years and continues to be with us. How this came about was, as Andrea was saying, we had a number of people on the board who did not even have homeowners insurance, and we really want the boards to reflect the communities that we serve as community mediation programs. We had heard of some threats to some other programs about possible litigation, and as the discussion ensued in the meeting, a board meeting one evening, one of the folks that we really, really valued, we value all of them, but one of these folks was saying, you know, that she thought she may have to quit the board just in the event that this should ever happen to Polk County. And so Lane Shutterly, whom I'm very honored to have on my advisory committee, picked this up and fashioned this amendment. And so I'm talking in support of this. And as Andrea was saying, over in Polk County, we have a budget of $71,300. And for us to come up with this kind of liability insurance is a real burden. We'd rather pour it into increasing wages, increasing our technology, finding greater office space, et cetera, et cetera.
Ms. Patterson, any questions for Ms. Patterson?
Kind of an inside deal.
Madam Chair, no, it's not. We have homeowners and umbrella coverage at our house. Madam Chair, if I may.
Yes, Representative Shetterly.
Just briefly to the bill. As you can see, and we have already a limitation on liability for those who actually perform the mediation services. And I think, as Ms. Patterson has said and as Andrea summarized, this is really intended, I think, to cover a gap in that the statute does not currently address basically directors and officers of these mediation programs who supervise the mediators. And these are the people who these programs depend on to operate, because you, to be a nonprofit organization, as most of these are, of course, you have to have a community board of directors. And sometimes it can get hard to recruit those if people aren't concerned about liability issues. And so since we had a statute that already extended the limitation of liability to those who actually do the mediation, it seemed like a small step to extend that one step further to the officers and directors. Also, I would point out on line 9, there is some amending language there that adds in bold print, or in providing other dispute resolution services. The statute as it reads right now simply is mediation, and some of these services provide a broader range of dispute resolution services than just mediation. So it's meant to cover the waterfront there, too.
Including training. We're constantly doing community education and training.
Thank you, Ms. Patterson.
Thank you.
Susan Brody.
Hi, Chair Walker and members of the committee. I'm Susan Brody. I'm Executive Director of the Oregon Dispute Resolution Commission. We provide technical assistance and grants to over 26 community dispute resolution centers throughout Oregon, 16 of which are nonprofits. And I'm just here today to lend our support to this legislation. We think it would be helpful to those community programs, and believe, for the reasons stated already, that this would help to alleviate any concerns that folks who are considering serving on boards of these organizations might have about their liability. I'm happy to answer any questions. I believe Andrea has provided for you a list of all the community programs in Oregon, and also a little bit of an explanation of what these community programs do, and what kind of activities they're involved in.
Any questions, Ms. Brody? Thank you very much. Is there anyone else here who did not sign up that wishes to testify on 2410? Okay. All right. Hearing is closed. Work session on 2410.
Madam Chair?
Yes, sir.
I move House Bill 2410 to the full committee with a due pass.
Any discussion? Any objection? House Bill 2410 passed to full committee with recommendation due pass.
Want me to take that?
Yes, sir. That would be wonderful, Mr. Shetterly.
Gosh, we're efficient today.
Not done yet.
Oh.
House Bill 2339. Did you pass that out for me?
Hi, Walter Daly, Chair Walker, members of the committee. I've just passed out some the testimony of Ms. Phelan, but in addition, Ann is passing out an amendment to the bill, and this was requested by Ms. Phelan and the other proponents of the bill. So I assume that we'll be talking about the bill with these amendments. And this bill is... one second. At this time, mediation programs under ORS 36180 to 36210 are voluntary, although several local judicial districts have put into their local rules things that very much encourage, if not require, people to enter into mediation programs. What this would do would, what this change in legislation would do would be to make mediation or referral to mediation mandatory. And according to the information I received from Ms. Phelan's office, experience in Oregon and other states document that where the mediation referral is mandatory, that the litigants often are more likely to select mediation. So that's the purpose of the bill. And I believe one concern that I've heard that needs to be addressed is how this bill deals with people that are in domestic violence type situations. That's one area of concern that, that needs to be addressed.
Okay, thank you. Alice Phelan?
Good morning, thank you. Chair Walker and members of the committee, I'm pleased to be here this morning. I'm Alice Phelan, and I'm the Director of the Court Community Justice Services Division for the Oregon Judicial Department, and I'm speaking in support of the bill. The, this bill actually addresses two issues related to mediation that the court and others have a concern about. The first part, which is Section 1 and 2, is the mandatory mediation referral process. House Bill 2339 would allow the courts to require parties to participate in mediation in certain types of cases, but before final judicial determination. Currently, ORS 36-400 and 405 now requires court-annexed arbitration for many cases and allows the parties to avoid arbitration if they've been through mediation. However, there's no statutory authority that allows the courts to mandate parties to participate in mediation similar to the one for arbitration. As Andrea cited in her remarks, certainly we found that state and nationally that mediation has been shown to be beneficial to the parties and that it's often less costly both to the parties and the courts for people to be using it early in the process. We've additionally found that it's particularly effective when we've had court in domestic relations and probate and guardianship proceedings. House Bill 2339 would provide courts with an additional tool for dispute resolution and allow courts to mandate its use in certain areas. The programs would be established by local rule, and we would believe this would be a particularly good complement to the already established mandated arbitration process. This piece of legislation is a permissive, and it allows for local decision making. We're not requiring that this be in place statewide. Certainly it would be important that the local court has determined that they have the resources to do this. Section 3 in the bill also addresses a mediation issue, and this is the funding of expanded domestic relations services. Current ORS 21.112 permits governing parties to establish a fee to be collected by the clerk of court in certain kinds of domestic relations proceedings to be used to be paid for the expenses of providing mediation, conciliation, and parenting time enforcement services. House Bill 2339 would expand the kinds of services that a court could utilize these funds for to include parent, divorce education, custody investigations and evaluations, and other services that have been approved by the presiding judge. Well, parent divorce education programs were mandated by the legislature in 1995, they allowed the judicial district to set up mandatory parent education programs. They did that because these programs have been shown nationally to be have a positive effect on the outcome of domestic relations proceedings by educating the parents about the impact of divorce on their children and the consequences of continued conflict. Most of Oregon's courts now mandate that parents attend such classes. In addition, several of our courts have established custody evaluation services where there's an assessment of the parents' strengths and weaknesses, as well as the needs of the children. This is undertaken so that there can be recommendations to the court regarding parenting time and custody time. Oregon's courts are seeking to implement innovations for special and high conflict families. These are supervised parenting time exchanges, parent coordination or referee programs, and non-adversarial investigations and evaluations. Well, currently some of our courts actually already utilize the funds that are collected under ORS 21.12112 for these programs, believing that they have a similar purpose and a result as those services specifically listed in the current statute. Adoption of House Bill 2339 would clarify that what is an existing practice in some courts is statutorily authorized and would permit other courts to consider and fund new innovative interventions to assist families and judges in these domestic relations proceedings. About the amendments that we've put in that are also on your desk, these proposed amendments would provide that the presiding judge would evaluate the needs and funding requirements for existing services, the mediation, conciliation, and the parenting time enforcement services, before approving the provision of parent education, custody evaluation services, or any other program that the courts or the parents, the courts, to assist the courts and parents in the domestic relations cases. The amendment, the clarifying amendment that we put together and put into the club before the committee today, we've done this in working with the existing domestic relations programs, the current family court services, because they were concerned that perhaps over the next few years there might be a displacement of those funds for their program services, and they wanted to ensure that there was statutory reference to first at the presiding judge evaluating what was in place and the needs for funding before funding any new programs. I urge you to favorably consider this bill, and I'd be glad to take any questions. Thank you.
If I could just interrupt, I wanted to point out to members of the committee that we also did just receive a fiscal statement, and hopefully you found that there is a fiscal statement in your pack of materials.
Andrea, I don't.
2352, but not 2339.
Oh, I have extra copies, but they should.
I don't have a fiscal.
Who's got yours, right?
Where is it? I don't see.
It's right here. This is the fiscal statement,
okay.
Right here.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Any questions for Ms. Phelan?
Madam Chair.
Representative Shetterly.
Not so much a question, but Council referred in her opening remarks to questions, I guess, about family abuse or domestic abuse proceedings. I would just point out that it seems to me, maybe Ms. Phelan can clarify, but I think those are already exempted under existing law, under the current statute. If you look on lines 5 and 6 of the bill, looking at current law, it says, after the appearance by all parties in any civil action except proceedings under ORS 107.700 to 107.732, those are the Family Abuse Prevention Act statutes. And it says, or 124.005 to 124.040, that's the elder abuse statutes. So this would not provide for mediation in those coming as it does under that same statute, as I understand.
Chair Walker and members of the committee, I know my colleague Dave Niebel is here and has also signed up to testify, and he's going to address the concern there, but that it is, as you said, Representative Shetley, the particular statutes you're referencing are when there are children involved in the domestic relations case, that the concern that's been addressed is that there is not the same kind of or similar provisions for domestic relations cases that do not have children. At issue. So,
any other questions? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
David Niebel.
Chair Walker, members of the committee, my name is David Niebel. I'm with the Oregon Law Center, and I'm here today representing the Oregon Alliance to End Violence Against Women. I just want to speak to the narrow issue that Representative Shetterly referred to just now. Our concern is that the bill would allow the court or a court to order mediation in a domestic relations proceeding in which children were not at issue. In other words, in which there were no custody or parenting time issues. The problem is not in subsection 1 of the bill. It's in subsection 2. You'll notice it says, except as provided in ORS 107.755 to 107.785. That's a statute that was passed in the 1997 session, I believe, that sets up a framework for mediating custody and parenting time disputes. I think that came out of the Oregon Task Force on Family Law. And it's very, very sensitive, admirably sensitive to domestic violence issues. Recognizes that domestic violence cases are not probably appropriate for mediation because of the power imbalance between the parties, but it only applies in cases in which parenting time or custody is in dispute. What we're concerned with is cases in which the parties may not have any children, so that's not an issue, but there's domestic violence involved, and we want to protect, give the same kind of protections to the domestic violence survivor in those cases, same kinds of protections against inappropriate mediation as exist now in cases involving parenting time and custody. I've brought this concern up with Ms. Phelan and other representatives of the Judicial Department, and they seem willing to work on an amendment. The amendment would actually need to be to ORS 107.755, I believe, and not to the statutes that are specifically involved in this bill now. So I'd be happy to try to answer any questions that the committee may have.
Okay. Any questions? Mr. Noble? No questions. Okay.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who wished to testify on this 2339 at this time? Okay. Thank you. Everyone has a copy of the amendments. Everyone has a copy of the bill. Okay. Hearing closed. Work session. House Bill 2339. Discussion?
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Shetterly.
I was just thinking if they've got amendments they're working on and coming back with, I'd be happy to wait until we see whatever they're able to put together before we move it. That's what I heard this morning anyway.
I understood the amendment from Mr. Noble would be on a different statute. It wouldn't be on this proposal. Is that correct? Or did I miss one?
Oh, no, I think you're right. I'm just looking at the relating clause. I think it could be done in this bill, and I wonder if they would rather just move the two together rather than pass it and then...
Would you prefer that? Come forward, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we could certainly work with them as quickly as possible to bring amendments back to this committee.
Okay. That would be fine. Please do that. Thank you. We will anticipate that amendment and reopen the session at a later date. House Bill 2352. Council, please read us in summary.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. As you'll see in my summary, this bill is intended to be a reorganization of Oregon civil rights statutes, and it clarifies unclear or inconsistent language relating to enforcement procedures. And I will defer to the speakers in terms of the specifics of the bill. According to the Oregon Law Commission, which presented this bill,
It only addresses the organizational problems of the current civil rights law without changing the substance. I would point out that there's a small amendment that you should have, and there's also a very short fiscal statement that you should have that arrived this morning.
Everyone have their fiscal statement and the amendment? Okay. We have Jeff Carter and Marsha Ohlmeyer, Oregon Law Commission. Marsha Ohlmeyer is Foley, Bureau of Labor Industries.
Chair Walker, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Carter. I actually am a member of the Oregon Law Commission, was the chair of this civil rights work group that presents the House Bill 2352 for your considerations. My comments are going to be somewhat brief this morning. We do have actually a written summary that will be submitted, I think, that hasn't already been circulated. That just gives a, it's our civil rights statutes report. It gives a background of the bill and kind of how our process worked. And my comments are going to be limited just to the process part, and then I'll turn it over to Marsha, who can talk a little bit more about the substantive part of the bill, and also Dave Hendricks from Legislative Council. As you know, Marsha's connected with Bureau of Labor Industries. She was part of the subgroup that worked with us, actually a major part of the subgroup, and so was Dave Hendricks. Other members of the subcommittee were Sandra Hansberger, who is also Oregon Law Commission member and currently also works at Northwestern School of Law in the legal in one of their consulting capacities up there. Bob Jundep of Oregon Advocacy Center was also a member of the committee. And what we tried to do was do the reorganization, as Andrea mentioned. This was a problem that was identified, or has been identified by a number of different interests, but more particularly Bureau of Labor and Industries, I believe either right prior or during the 1999 session, identified this as a problem, that there's a need for a rewrite, and because of the nature and the size of that task, it was decided not to go forward in the 1999 session, and it was a through the recommendation of Bureau of Labor and Industries and also Mr. Hendricks, the issue was presented to the Oregon Law Commission as one of their projects, and it was adopted by a program committee. And then the smaller initial committee met at least 7 or 8 times, put together the initial draft, and then we, I believe somewhere in the neighborhood of 80 people were contacted that were work within the area to get their input, and as a result of that process and the input from those interested parties, you have before you the end result, which is House Bill 2352. In the summary that has been circulated, it refers to LC, Legislative Council Draft 371. Obviously, that's the same product. I just wanted to make that that clear. One of the, I guess, mantras that we had through this process was that we did not want to make any substantive changes. We really were looking at trying to make this a more user-friendly statute. There were difficulties as a result of the statute developing over time with new provisions being added and referenced back to other provisions, in particular the like the remedies section. There was confusion about what remedies actually apply to certain civil rights violations. So the purpose was simply to go forward and try to do the reorganization, as I indicated, without any substantive changes. Now, you will have also before you a proposed amendment, and Dave Hendricks will talk to the specifics of that, and I am bringing that up
primarily because as a result of our desire to maintain the substantive law without any changes, I believe this is one of the amendments that will keep us true to that commitment. The other issue relates to the whistleblower statute limitation, and that will be a I know that Rudy Westerband here, City of Portland's attorney, or for Portland City attorney, is here to talk about that. There was a change from a 90-day statute limitations to a one-year statute limitations. We had a little bit of a problem in that there's, as you all know, a 180-day notice requirement for bringing action against public bodies. That was a obviously inconsistent with the 90-day limitation. There was also a court case that looked at that Draper versus Astoria School District, it's a 1998 case, and their comments were in relation to the statute, the quintessential camel designed by a committee. So that was the problem that we had. We tried to address that, and I believe both Marcia and Mr. Westerman can speak to that. That's really all the comments that I have at this time, and I'll just turn it over to Marcia and David if you want to step up to speak to the amendment that you have before you.
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, my name is Marcia Ole Miller. I am the legal policy advisor for the Oregon Bureau of Labor and Industries. And as Mr. Carter pointed out, Bowley was aware that there were a number of what we call glitches with Chapter 659 that we'd sort of learned to live with, inconsistencies, things that seem to be in some cases a product of maybe establishing new statutory protections without fully cross-referencing them through the statute. So we had such anomalies as Bowley having jurisdiction over some violations but no authority to investigate, cease and desist orders being available under some statutes where Bowley had jurisdiction but not under others. Things that seemed clearly to be, there was no logical explanation for them. And as I said, we tried to work around them. In 1999, we came forward with what we called a housekeeping bill, which was really sort of a chewing gum and baling wire attempt to fix the glitches, and Ledge Council generously suggested at that point that there could be a lot more wrong with the statute than just the things we were pointing out, that the whole organization of it had some problems, which we agreed with. Ultimately, the outcome was, of course, that the Oregon Law Commission adopted Chapter 659 for a hard look, put a work committee on it, and did a substantial proposed reorganization, which we at Bowley really appreciate. We think this could result in the statutes being much more user-friendly, not only for the public, but for those of us professionals at Bowley and advocates who use them all the time. So I think the general organization of the bill is pretty straightforward. The one thing that was accomplished was that, for instance, the statutes of limitation used to be scattered throughout the chapter. They're all under one section now. All the provisions about administrative hearings are in one place. The attempt was to put them in a chronological order so that as a complaint comes through the front door of Bowley, you see through these various sections, it's investigated, charges may be brought, a settlement attempt may be made, a hearing may be requested, those kinds of things, so that it just follows one action on another, a great improvement over what there is now. I will tell you, although it's not apparent when you look at the bill, that you can take the sections of this bill and refer back to current law with pretty much every sentence that's there. It is substantially a rearrangement, not a complete rewriting. No substantive rights were taken away or added. As far as we know, the endeavor was not to do that. And so just as an overview of the bill, chapter sections 1 through 15 are largely procedural, and then everything after that are conforming amendments, which is where you take the substantive statute and take the part of it that refers to Bowley jurisdiction or Bowley procedure and conform that language. It used to be that, or it is currently, I should say, in the law, that some statutes are prohibit unlawful practices, and other statutes prohibit unlawful employment practices. And as these statutory protections were added, each substantive statute would have its own little bully enforces this, and under the provisions of these statutes, et cetera. Well, now, in the bill, you'll have two types of violations, unlawful practice or unlawful employment practice. Bully has jurisdiction over those. So each substantive provision doesn't have to refer back to BOLI jurisdiction. They all, by virtue of being unlawful practices or unlawful employment practices, that takes you back into the BOLI procedural sections. Beyond that, I think that pretty well describes what the bill would do. It would take all the BOLI, the statutes that BOLI has jurisdiction over, and put them all together, and then the other remaining civil rights statutes that are not currently enforced by BOLI, some are enforced by other agencies, some are enforced only through private action, would be in a chapter unto themselves. So as far as the matter of whether things were changed, as Mr. Carter stated, we endeavored not to make substantive changes, even though sometimes we had to overlook some things that seemed to really be crying out to be addressed, but we knew that advocates on both sides could feel that we were making changes, and in order to get this bill through, which we feel is really important to reorganize the chapter and make it more usable, we didn't want to load it up with things that, even though we might think were improvements, other people could see as drastic changes and bring in a whole other level of debate to this bill, which we had hoped to avoid. I should also say, however, that whether some of the things that we did resulted in substantive changes, reasonable minds can sometimes differ, and there are a couple of those things that are going to be the subject of discussion today where we felt there was a lack of clarity, and other people may have felt that we actually made a change. So I'd be happy to take any questions or defer to Mr. Hendricks, who's the author of this bill and can speak to the specifics maybe better than I can if you have questions.
Are there any questions of Mr. Carter or Ms. Bowen-Miller this time? Okay. You may proceed. Please state your name for the record.
Chair Walker, members of the committee, I'm David Hendricks, Senior Deputy Legislative Counsel, and I did provide drafting services on the bill. A lot of this bill, when you look at it to some degree, it's probably pretty hard for a lot of folks, including legislators, to figure out what's going on in some of these sections once you get past the black letter stuff at the beginning. And some of this, I guess, I would kind of characterize as inside baseball for legislative counsel, because in order to figure out what's going on here, it's almost better to go with the summaries that we provide rather than trying to figure it out from the language. The concept here is, though, to basically split the existing Chapter 659 and create a chapter that has those things that are subject to BOLI jurisdiction in one chapter. Right now, there's a mishmash of things that are subject to BOLI jurisdiction and things that are not. And it's very confusing. It's very hard to understand. It relies a lot on doing a lot of reading of little series references, some of which have become conflicting over time. So the concept is to clean that mess up and basically say, here's the chapter that's got some of these prohibited practices where there are other remedies available, such as criminal actions or other things. And here are the ones that you can file a complaint with BOLI with. And as a practical matter, I believe almost all of those are also ones in which you can file a lawsuit under the existing law with the court if you have an employer or other person engages in these practices that are declared to be impermissible. The one thing I would say on substantive versus, I just want to mention, you know, the work group, I worked with them very closely, and I will say there was an extreme sensitivity to not making changes in substance. Perhaps more so than almost any other group I've worked with probably over the last few sessions. I mean, a lot of concern that this not turn into a bill, because the fear always was if you open that door. There were some, you cannot say, I think, with absolutely total, gee, there are no substantive changes, because there are a lot of ambiguities in the statutes that existed here. And one of the things that happen when you write a clear statement is, and you remove ambiguity, you may remove somebody's argument for what this law meant. What exists here, though, was intended to be the best consensus with respect to what those sections were intended to mean in the first place. That's what they were aiming at. The one issue that has come up where there was a change in a statute of limitation I'm aware of, clearly that's a substantive change. And I would tell you that the work group did not feel comfortable doing that, and they took it to the full commission with a range of options because of the existing problem with this law that had a non-standard statute of limitations and some of the problems it created when you look at other laws that deal with suing public bodies, the Torts Claim Act, and saying, well, what's your desire? It was one of those that was had created a big problem that the federal courts had identified as being a problem, and the commission's direction at that point was to go to the one-year statute of limitations, which was a change. So, you know, I hate to have the impression that there's absolutely nothing in here that constitutes a change in any substance, but clearly the effort here was to keep it as non-substantive as possible, to really just identify those things where clarification could be made to assist both practitioners and other people who might have claims under the civil rights to know how you go about seeking a remedy when one of these laws are violated. The one amendment that you do have before you addresses a single sentence on page 7 of the bill, and this is actually part of the discussion we had with respect to the interrelationship of the civil rights laws with the laws that allow people to sue public bodies in tort. There had always been a little bit of perhaps dispute about whether or not when you had a claim against public body and it was because of a violation, an unlawful practice, an unlawful discriminatory act, whether or not the rules in the laws relating generally to suing public bodies applied, or whether the laws relating in Chapter 659 on civil rights applied. For instance, whether or not the two-year statute of limitations in the laws relating to suing public bodies, the Torts Claim Act applied, or the one-year statute of limitations in Chapter 659 applied. And the commission said, let's clear this up. And one of the things that we put in was that basically with respect to the required notice of 180-day notice of a claim against a public body, we added a sentence saying that filing a lawsuit against the public body would constitute notice. And it was pointed out by some of the practitioners in that area, well, that may not actually be actual notice. There are scenarios that you can imagine where you would file the complaint within the 180-day notice and not serve them until after, so they wouldn't have actual notice. So they were arguing that this was a substantive change. I don't think it's a significant sentence. I think that the intent of this section was basically to clarify the interrelationship. So the removal of that sentence, I think all of the members of the work group were consulted, as I understand, and everybody thought that was a good amendment to make. And then the last thing I'll say before I shut up is I had a call from Michael Dale of the Oregon Advocacy Center, who does a lot of work representing farm workers and people. And they had asked for some changes in two of the sections of the bill. Section 86A and Section 87 that relate to specifically to farm worker issues. We had made the changes at their request, and everybody was comfortable with them. He had some last remaining concerns about whether or not it could be argued that with the changes we've made, somebody other than currently is authorized to sue would be able to sue it. In other words, that there might be a restriction. He asked me, I told him that my opinion was is that the language didn't do that. He asked if I would state on the record that, you know, that this is not intended in any way to change who it is that can bring an action under these sections, and I told him I would do that for him. I performed that duty, and I will be quiet and answer any questions you might have.
Okay, thank you. Anyone have any questions of this panel?
I do have a comment.
Representative Lowe.
Madam Chairman, thanks. This needed to happen, and it was a monumental task. I really appreciate that.
Madam Chair, just a footnote. I think the commission, this is going to be taken up to the next programs committee, but I think we're probably going to be going back and looking at some of those difficult substantive law changes for next session. And I think that's going to be our next chapter as far as our subcommittee is concerned, if the full commission makes that decision. So we're not abandoning those issues. We're going to actually go back and revisit them and see how we come out for 2003, I guess.
And I will make one more comment, if I could, please. On the issue of whether or not filing a suit within 180 days against a public body constitutes notice, I do know that a lot of, well, at least one lower court has ruled that that is sufficient, and the case was not appealed, that particular case, so that seems to be current practice.
Chair Walker, Representative Lowe, I think that, again, you know, we kept trying to keep the work group was, when I was working with them, we're really trying to keep the big picture in mind. Right now, there's no explanation in the statutes about how 659 relates to the Torts Claim Act. It's really, you know, that's what the federal courts were dealing with when they had a case that was brought up to them where 659 was involved. And so at least the bill still does that. It explains. It says, yes, these are, and it tells you which statute of limitation to use. It says you do have to give the 180-day notice. So it clarifies a lot of those things. And if this particular aspect, you know, doesn't happen in this bill or isn't clarified as far as the effect, I don't think, you know, again, looking at the big picture, I think the work group was saying that's not a big issue for them anyway.
Representative Lowe, just to clarify the record, I think the concern relating to the amendment that's being offered this morning was whether a BOLI complaint is a sufficient tort claim notice, not a lawsuit. And so I think that was the area where we felt was clarification, they felt was a change.
Any other questions? Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Rudolph Westerman.
I have the difficult task of being in favor and against.
Is that now neutral?
I too must thank the Oregon Law Commission for the reorganization of the 659 civil rights laws. It's putting them in one chapter in a reader-friendly fashion is something that any practitioner would be in favor of. On the other hand, I represent the city of Portland, and I should say that first, and I'm here on behalf of the city of Portland. For a little while ago, I was the state's attorney in charge of labor and employment matters, but I left in November, and now I'm back in the city where I live. Doing the same thing for the city as I did with the state. The stakeholders were informed by the Oregon Law Commission that there were no substantive changes, and I relied on that representation and asked our Office of Intergovernmental Relations to support this measure, support this bill. Just last week, however, on Thursday, I was reviewing the bill with one of the attorneys in the office very carefully and discovered that there was a substantive change. I contacted Marsh, and the substantive change is the deletion of the language in Section 45, which required expressly, it's the italicized language there, expressly required a lawsuit to be filed within 90 days of the occurrence. that's, the deletion of that language is clearly a substantive change, and it's a significant substantive change for public employers. The thinking of the Oregon Law Commission was that why not conform all of the statutes to the same statute of limitations? We think that there are reasons why you shouldn't do that. There are significant legal policy reasons why you shouldn't do that. Whistleblower statutes are a new creature, relatively speaking, unlike the sex and race discrimination statutes. When we passed our law in 1989, there were only six states that had them. Two of them had the 90-day period. We modeled ours after a couple of those states. There was concern on the part of members of the legislature that the whistleblower statute would invite abuse by employees for whom the statute wasn't passed to protect, in the sense that, unlike the other civil rights laws, the whistleblower statute has some elements which are very subjective, and they depend upon the employee's belief as opposed to what actually is the case. The employee reasonably believes that there is evidence of mismanagement. That kind of case needs to be brought to the public employer's attention immediately. The longer you wait for someone to come up with an allegation of that nature, the less you're able to track it down, to investigate, assess, and perhaps defend, the longer the case hangs. And it may be for that very reason that there was a 90-day limit in the statute. We need the reorganization of those laws, but we do also need to take a very careful and studied look, as was suggested would happen next session, at substantive changes deliberately. We need to see what this legislature considered back in 1989. And why it did what it did. We need to consider what legislatures have been doing since 1989. The quick look that I've had, and this is just a couple of days. I mean, we saw the substantive change. I think it was on Wednesday, and I called Marsha O. Miller on Thursday. Marsha, I might have the days wrong. It might have been both on Thursday, but in any event. We did some very quick research, and we see some trends. The state of Washington, for example, has a 30-day time limit, 30 days. And there is no lawsuit. You file with an administrative body like the Employment Relations Board of this state, like the Bureau of Labor and Industries of this state. California has a 12-month period, but it's all administrative, again, like Washington. So the West Coast there is a right of action in court. That's only if the administrative body decides not to proceed. The trend appears to be to have a long period of time where the basis for a claim is narrow. For example, the employee believes there's been a violation of law. But if the basis for the complaint is broad or subjective, the trend appears to be, and this is on a very quick look, to have some sort of administrative process or to have a shorter time frame, as in our current law. It made sense, at least prima facie to conform the statutes, but whether or not it actually makes sense is something that needs a deliberate look. The entire bill is fine, except for Section 45, and I believe that's the section that needs to remain as is in the law currently. So Section 45 should be deleted, if that made any sense. I'm proposing that we delete Section 45, that this committee, that this body delete Section 45. I do want to see this bill go forth. It would be a shame that it not go forth. But on the other hand, as those who preceded me indicated, there are two sides, at least, with regard to some of these substantive issues. This is one of them. I really do believe that the public interest would be served by the legislature looking at whether or not it makes sense, if you have a broad statute like ours, with a great deal of subjectivity, to have a short time frame. Get that before the employer quickly as to what the person is alleging. I mean, you can have a situation where someone, a year down the road, after the event, is claiming that, I complained about the watershed something or other. And the public body or the manager is, what watershed something or other? It's very much different than an allegation that some law was violated. That needs to be gotten to the public body's attention quickly. And this body may also consider whether it's appropriate to have that reviewed in some sort of administrative context, as opposed to immediately filing in court. So we are requesting that Section 45 be deleted from this bill.
Okay. Any questions? Representative Shirley.
Well, I guess just a fair comment that, as the first panel said, I think it's accurate that what's substantive is sometimes in the eye of the beholder, and there are degrees, I guess, of substantiveness. I understand Mr. Wasserman?
Westerman,
I'm sorry. Saying, by the same token, the issue is before us. Granted, this bill came from the Law Commission, but now it's in the possession of the Judiciary Committee, and I think we can do what we want to with the bill. I'm not offended by a policy that says we've got something that's inconsistent here. I mean, granted, whatever other states are doing, we have in Oregon a Tort Claims Act that says if you are going to bring an action against a public body, you have 180 days to file the notice and then a year to sue. But we have this kind of oddball whistleblower statute relating, again, just to claims against public bodies. This is just a matter of claims against public bodies. This isn't an issue of private liability. That has, in the statute that created it, this anomalous 90-day statute of limitations. And I don't know that a whistleblower statute is necessarily any more subjective than a great many tort claims are that would come up under the tort. I was damaged, whether or not you violated my rights. That's largely a subjective kind of issue that is dealt with adequately under the scheme for filing notice and the period for the Tort Claims Act. Substantive change in the law that the bill does, I'm certainly not I'm not offended by it. Having these disparate periods of limitation. And also, I guess there's two sides of the coin. Mr. Westerman refers to the 90-day statute as being important to get the matter in front of the employer quickly. Of course, the other side of that coin is also a matter of cutting off claims.
that's an employer concern about these as well, that we need to balance that against the other, the larger universe of the possible claims against the public body. And I don't think there's anything wrong with them.
Any other question of Mr. Westland? Thank you very much, Mr. Westland. Appreciate your comments. Betsy Earle.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Betsy Earles, representing Associated Oregon Industries. And I'm here this morning at the request of the Bureau of Labor and Industries just to put on the record that AOI has no objection to this bill. From our perspective, there are no substantive changes to the law. We appreciate the reorganization, so we're not opposed.
Questions on Ms. Earles?
How do you define substantive?
We're not going to talk about that today. Probably a whole course on that one. But thanks for asking.
Thank you, Ms. Earle.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who wishes to comment on this today?
Actually, for the record, I'm Brian DeLeischmidt, representing a number of folks, the Oregon Nurses Association, the Oregon Council of Police Associations, the Association of Oregon Corrections Employees, and the Federation of Oregon Parole and Probation Officers. I've sent this bill to the attorneys for all those bodies and have not heard back. So I guess the one comment I would have is I don't know whether there's substantive changes in there at this point, and hopefully you're not going to move to work session today on this bill. If so, then obviously I need to catch it on the other side. Thank you.
Any questions of Mr. DeLeischmidt?
Madam Chair, yes.
Representative Shirley.
Blaine, when did you send this out, you know? This was published and out in LC form back in November.
I was not aware of it in November, and actually I got it when it was in printed form. To the best of my knowledge, and I can't speak for the attorneys that represent those organizations, I don't believe that they had any draft of this from Boley or anyone else prior to me sending them the printed copy when it came out.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. I see that there are some definite opinions about this bill. And Mr. DeLeischmidt's comment that some folks had not seen this yet. I personally don't have any objection to allowing them next week for our work session to allow them the opportunity to respond and for us to consider the additional comments of our witnesses here today. And so if council would schedule us for next week for our work session, I will close the hearing. Thank you very much.